Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, you can also listen live on the homepage of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood isn't, go ahead, make my news. And my very special guest today, who's also, incidentally, from the fabulously fluoridated island change procrastination of New Zealand and the sunny slave South Pacific, where everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb thanks to the Fukushima radiation, which the Prime Minister thinks is a good idea. It's Billy McKee from Green Cross New Zealand. Incidentally, marijuana is a good treatment for radiation, I hear. Billy, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Billy. Nice to be here.
How are you, mate? Are you still wearing your ankle bracelet?
No, I've got my ankle bracelet off. I've appealed my charges and it's going back to court in about a month. So I'm sort of frantically, you know, working on my court case at the moment. I've had heaps of trouble with lawyers. You know, they just didn't want to do what I wanted them to do. So we're sort of, I've had to do it myself, and it's been a real struggle. But anyway, we're back to the Court of Appeal and see if we can get some progress out of that. It's not going to be easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I doubt it would be. And you know what's interesting though, Billy, is that recently there's been a lot of movement on the cannabis front. It's getting legalized and decriminalized all over the show. There was a big debate on TV3, The Vote, where 70% of people came in and voted on various different platforms, all saying, yes, we want it legal. And what I found interesting about that, and the funniest part was, of course, Peter Dunn, the Associate Health Minister, who's funded by Big Tobacco and Big Liquor, saying, well, nah.
Exactly, eh? No budge, no movement whatsoever on a topic that's just so important. You know, especially for medical side of it, Vinnie, you know, because I've got some of people contacting me just about every day. They've got serious health issues, you know, they're dying, they've got heaps of pain on, you know, and they're sort of contacting me just about every day, sort of begging me for stuff, and it really hurts me to say that, you know, I can understand where you're coming from and that, but I just can't help you with any medicine. And it's just proven, especially that Rick Simpson oil, have you heard of that?
So yeah, especially we've had Rick Simpson on. We've had Rick Simpson on a number of times for the show.
Yeah, okay, oh, of course, yeah. So that's working really good. And I had a trial run of it for a while, you know, but I didn't have enough of it. But when I was using it, gee, I felt fantastic. I felt like I was young again, you know. Mm. Yeah.
So well, I thought I only had it for a couple of
weeks. Oh?
It does rejuvenate you. And also, Billy, your speakers are a little bit loud, so there's a tad bit of feedback, so if you can turn those down just a little bit.
Okay, how's that?
Much better.
Okay.
Yep. No echo. Okay. In terms of medical cannabis, what's the issue here? Because I think to myself, look, you've got a very sick person here. You got somebody who is about to die, and you know that there's a substance that is not dangerous, not prohibitively expensive, and will, in fact, cure or at least ease their condition, and then you refuse to give it to them on the basis of, air quotes, it's illegal. And in my opinion, that mentality is, in air quotes, immoral. So you've got a bunch of immoral sociopathic maybe I'm going a little overboard here. Maybe actually I'm understating that.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Immoral sociopathic greedy swines.
There's also the ignorance of it. And you know what occurred to me during that debate that they had about cannabis on TV3 is that one side that was pro-legalization was using facts and figures, and the other side were using fear-mongering and lies with no evidence to back up their case whatsoever.
Yeah, well, it's hard for them to get evidence to back up
their case. It's because it doesn't exist.
Yeah, so they've got to rely on fear-mongering and lies.
I have this real great kind of like sick pit in my stomach. Whenever I think about cannabis legalization, you know, I've got two convictions, and the old saying goes, you know, your only beef with something is worth as much as your convictions, and I've got two of them, so therefore I can easily debate about this topic. I was talking to Dr. Green on the Skype just earlier, and the Dactory closed down December 2012. And they're moving to a new place in the little old heartland of New Zealand in Taumarunui, where they're going to be opening up an even bigger Dactory that's like twice the size.
Fantastic, eh? Yeah, I was talking to Dr. Green last night. It's absolutely incredible what he's done there. He's a real champion, eh?
Oh, yeah. And also, because of the timing of it, I would think that this whole cannabis debate in New Zealand wouldn't really have come about had it not been for the efforts of people like Dr. Green, who basically he obtained more media attention in the public eye than any other singular cannabis figure that I've ever heard of in this country's history. And I believe that maybe as a direct result of that, it's had an effect on the public consciousness.
Yeah, he certainly had an influence. Certainly put every effort into it over the last few years, quite a few years actually. He's put a huge amount of effort into it. He does deserve recognition for what he's done, getting the topic up there. The thing is, though, Vinnie, you know, if we weren't dealing with a corrupted government, we wouldn't have to go into all this effort. There's been heaps of evidence come through for a long, long time from different advisory groups on changing the laws, and the government just chucks it up straight out, you know, altogether. So that, to me, indicates that the government is quite corrupt, and they can just quickly, you know, ignore evidence-based recommendations and carry on with something that everybody knows is not working. It's just corruption.
Well, who's benefiting as well? You know, I was just thinking about this the other day. Is the old saying, ki bono, who benefits? And I don't see anybody benefiting from cannabis prohibition in the general public. Like, anybody who uses it while it's illegal, there's plenty of health benefits and so on and so forth, relieving of stress, symptomology, etc. Yet the people who never use it, I don't think they've benefited at all from it being illegal. You know?
Right. It would have cost them a lot because, you know, there's heaps of money being spent on the war on drugs, but plus also there's a lot of crime has been generated because of the prohibition laws. You know, I even know people that have been killed, you know, over cannabis. And that never would have happened if it hadn't been prohibited. prohibited. It would have been, you know, if it had been on the regulated market or something safe like that, these people never would have died. And you know, a lot of people get armed robberies and home invasions and beaten up and stuff like that. You know, and none of that would have ever happened. And yeah, lots of burglaries go on. People, you know, I've heard of people stealing, you know, stuff from people's houses, you know, like expensive stuff, and then swapping it for tinnies. I'm going, oh my God, you know.
It's freaking insane. Are there people out there who like flog off a 48-inch TV and then go into the local liquor shop and go, hey, bro, I'll give you this 48-inch HD TV if you give me a bottle of Jack? It just doesn't happen in a regulated market.
Yeah. It could never happen, though. And also, it's put the price up a lot. You know, the cost of producing cannabis is actually pretty low, but by the time you've got the prohibited market, it pushes the price right up. You know, I see some of the places over in the States where it's legalized now, the price is coming down.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you can grow it yourself, how much does it cost you?
Yeah.
Virtually nothing.
Yeah, very much. I know.
Yeah. And if that was the case... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, one of the main things that stops people growing their own is... well, there's two things, really. There's the police is a sort of a bit of an issue, but the main thing, I think, is actually people stealing it. You know, a lot in this area here, there used to be quite a few, you know, your backyard growers and stuff like that. But, you know, young criminals were going through the backyard stealing all the cannabis, so people, you know, just got to stop growing it, only for that reason. But, you know, that's sort of, you know, if people stopped stealing it, it would be all over the place. The police couldn't control that many plants and that many growers.
There's two bunches of people in this country that I really don't like. One being the police, and the other being the gangs, which are, you know, which are the reason why they're coupled together is because they're both fracking gangs who engage in criminal activity and make people's life freaking miserable.
Yeah,
a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah, and if it wasn't for cannabis or if it wasn't for the prohibition laws, neither of those gangs would have very much power. Would reduce their power hugely.
It's true. And I also wanted to talk to you, Billy, about your personal experience with this as well, and tell people the story about how you actually came to be the head of Green Cross New Zealand, if you would.
Okay. There's another guy, Greg, set up Green Cross, and him and a bunch of people in Auckland actually set it up. And they run it quite successfully for a couple of years, but Greg was... had AIDS, and he was getting really, really sick. So, you know, and he had difficulty carrying on with it, so he just asked me to take over Green Cross. So I actually didn't really want to, but I did anyway. And it's been a really difficult job to have, because you don't get any pay, and you get a lot of people ringing up, you know, and quite often late at night, and they're in a high levels of pain, and sometimes they've even, you know, they've even been using prescription drugs, which actually, you know, beats someone's brains around a little bit. You know, it's not good for your brain, some of that stuff. So you get a lot of phone calls from that, and sometimes it's quite abusive and threatening and stuff like that, you know, because they really want the medicine that will work for them. And I can't blame them at all. You know, they've used cannabis before, people are ringing up, and they know it works for them, but they can't get any, so they're ringing me up and putting pressure on me to get it for them. And it's been really difficult, especially because you know that they're genuine, you know that they're not just bullshitting, you know, like undercover cop, you know, he was just a bullshitter, but, you know, everybody else is just sort of, you know, they're genuine, and they've got kids that are dying and stuff like that, and I'll tell you what, mate, you really want to help them. Yeah, and that's actually how I got into trouble, was, you know, trying to help these people. And it, you know, even now, I still believe I have a moral right to help somebody. If someone says, oh, I'm sick, I'm dying, or something like that, you know, can you help me, or will you help me? You sort of, you know, you should help them. You know, if you see somebody drowning, or you see someone, you know, about to walk out in front of a car, and you can stop them and you can help them, well, that's what you do. Hey, you see young people, you know, I'm dealing with this quite regularly, young people that are suicidal and stuff like that. You know, if you can help them, you do. This is what you normally do. So, it's been a stressful job. I'm actually leaving Green Cross now. It's all been too much for me, and I'm going to sort of you know, I'm thinking about pulling out of quite a few things because the stress has just been up for me, and you know, I'm sort of, yeah, I'm having difficulty hanging in there, Vinny.
Well, I've found activism is a very thankless job, and the only thanks you get, well, actually, let me redefine that. Activism, yeah. You get a lot of thanks, but not a whole lot of support.
Yeah.
All right? Yeah. If people say, thank you for doing what you're doing, that doesn't help me, bro. Okay? You know? I mean, sure, thank you for saying thank you, but those are just words.
Yeah.
Where are your actions? What else are you contributing? How are you helping me? Because if you're going to say thank you to me for doing all this hard work, what about if you helped me do this hard work? What if you supported, you know?
Yeah, and then there would be not so much hard work for me. And you know, we tried to get the Cannabis Protest Weekly going at all the courts in New Zealand, you know, because there's heaps of people going up every week at court. We thought, right, if we can get all these people that are coming up every week to bring their mates along, and we all come along to court every week at all the courts in New Zealand, then we'll have enough people to actually shut the courts down. And if we can shut them down, this is how the government controls us, is through the courts. But the courts are actually a bit of a weak link. You know, if we had quite a few people there, and it's only, you know, a couple of mornings a week, and put that much pressure on it that they have difficulty functioning, then we'd possibly get some changes done to the drug laws there. I don't believe that we're going to get any changes done to the drug laws by begging for crumbs from the table from the very people that actually made these laws up and put us in this position. You know, they're not going to give us anything. They've said that quite.
Trying to say to the government, look, please stop being criminal scum. It's like negotiating with terrorists. You just can't negotiate with them, eh? They just take and destroy everything they touch.
Yeah, there's no end to them. And the other thing is, we tried to get protests going, focus on Peter Dunne, because he's another weak link, you know. But we just couldn't get the people that actually wanted to make an effort to come out for a day or something and you know, and sort of do some protest actions against them. They just wouldn't do it. So, you know, I sort of feel like I'm, you know, running a walker on my own, and it's too much to row on my own. So, you know, I've got, you know, my health has been going down steadily, and, you know, I'm sort of stuck in a career.
Well, hold on. We're coming up to break now. There's the music, Billy. We'll be right back in about 3 to 4 minutes.
Yep.
With more information on all of this, ladies and gentlemen. And if you want to support Green Cross, go to greencross.org.nz, I believe it is. Is that right?
Yep.
All right. Yep. Dang, I'm good. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Oh, go on, you buddy.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. I have, you know, I think I've actually put more New Zealand activists on air, on terrestrial radio, than any one person or any one news organization in this country's history. And that's quite an achievement for one person to organize by themselves. And it just goes to show you don't need massive organizations that have huge quantities of funding and million-dollar studios and so on and so forth in order to get the frickin' job that needs to be done accomplished. Because I think that what's wrong with humanity is that people have decided that they need to depend on others in order to get anything of worth accomplished. And I don't think this is the case. And I think history is on my side on this, that it's usually a small amount of very talented and or dedicated individuals who get things done and actually change the course of humanity. Whether or not I'm actually changing the course of humanity, I don't know. It's not really my goal. My goal is just to give some coverage to people who otherwise would get left out of the media because they're such a bunch of inept scum that they just couldn't be bothered. And also they're not that bright either. What's his name? Ian Wishart told me, and he was like one of the country's top journalists, Billy, that reporters are airheads. Okay, I want to get that on a plaque. you know, just on my desk or something. Ian Wishart, mainstream media reporters are just a bunch of airheads who are just wanting their next trip to Tahiti, and that's basically it. These are the people that you get to inform you, ladies and gentlemen, on a day, on a day-to-day basis. If you're listening to this show, you have suddenly joined an elite minority of people who know what the frack they're talking about. At least it's something nice, you know? And by the way, the reason why I'm saying this is because Billy has actually been supporting me for quite some time. You've got the automatic payments going into my my Kiwi Bank and everything, and that's helping me pay the rent, pay the food, pay the internet bills, and things like that. So he's an activist who's on the bones of his ass, and even he's capable of supporting me on a regular basis. Thank you, Billy.
You're well worth it.
Yeah, and at the moment, ladies and gentlemen, I'm having a real struggle. We don't have any money for food at the moment. We've got the rent covered. Internet bill's just been paid, but what's left over is not enough for food or the non-fluoridated water that we have to buy because this frickin' city won't get it out of the water. But Hamilton's just voted to get fluoride out of the water, but Auckland is just too dumb and too lazy, and we can't be bothered. We just want to drive around in our cars and sip our frickin' fluoridated lattes at various cafes around the city that are incidentally run by Chinese people. It'll be fine. Oh, God. But anyway, if you could please, ladies and gentlemen, do me a solid. Go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. There's a little PayPal subscribe button there. I want you to start donating on a monthly basis. If you are broke as frack, you can still afford $1 a month. If you are flush with cash, you might be able to afford $100 a month. And those options are there for you. And what do you get for that? You get ad-free archives and also the knowledge that I will still be here, still 5 days a week, broadcasting the truth and giving people the coverage that they fracking deserve. I'm doing the job that the media can't be bothered doing because they're too inept, too pathetic, and too controlled to get the job done right. Please, and I mean like right now, seriously, the situation is quite desperate. Please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, subscribe either through PayPal with your credit card or just make an automatic payment through the Kiwi Bank account there. And if you're unable to, say, do something regular, there's a little donate button there as well. And I must say, I've had so much support from so many people over the years that I don't own anything I'm wearing. You know that? I seriously, Billy, everything that I've got, everything that I'm wearing on my body and everything that is in this office around me has been given to me by other people. I would not be able to do this show if it weren't for the generous support of the listeners, okay? It's a symbiotic relationship here, and I feel obligated, because I've got this stuff, to use it for good, for you. Right, that's enough self-promo for one day. But I hope people take it seriously. Billy, where were we before we were coming off? We were talking about activism and how it doesn't pay off a lot of the time. Ironically, that's a good segue.
It's certainly a hard path to go down, eh? And it, even quite often I find the people that are, you know, that you sort of think that would be supporting you, you know, don't. You know, and it's sort of, you know, it's sort of disheartening when that happens, you know, sort of like, you know, people think, oh, these guys are just a handicap, they actually turn around and undermine you sometimes, and it just sort of takes the energy out of you. Yeah, so it's, and sort of, we've been trying other things as well, and it just seems, you know, it's just hard to get support. That's why I thought, you know, like, because you're doing the radio station and that, and you're doing such a good job, I thought, heaps of people have been donating to you, you know, you have money coming out of your ears and stuff. Yeah, which you should do. If everybody, you know, chips in a little bit, it won't be a problem. But, you know, from the sound of it, we haven't got enough food, but we're not doing that, eh?
So. Oh, well, I think I blame PayPal because I had a reasonable amount of subscribers and I had all the bills paid, everything was going sweet, and then PayPal froze my account, saying that I need to register as a charitable organization before I can continue. I'm not a charitable organization, am I? I'm just a person who was accepting donations from people. And so they froze my account, and I think there's still like $600-$700 in there or something like that that I can't touch. A lot of most of the people who were subscribed to me back in the day had their subscriptions cancelled and didn't renew them on the new PayPal account that I opened. So, you know, it's just took me quite a few years to build up that backlog of support, and with one fell swoop,
yeah,
gone. And yeah, I've been struggling ever since. For the last couple of months since that happened, have been really, really tough.
PayPal did the same to WikiLeaks, didn't they?
I don't know.
Yeah, because we were donating to WikiLeaks, and when that stuff started happening with Julian Assange, and then they were calling for more donations to, you know, when he was getting arrested and stuff and hiding out in England, and so they were calling for more donations for that, and, you know, like, if I've got some money, I'll donate, you know, to someone like that. And then PayPal wouldn't let the payments go through. So maybe not so accidental.
Yeah. Well, I remember at the time Sarah's car blew up. Well, not blew up like by the CIA or something, but the engine fracked out, and it was going to be more expensive to actually get a new engine than it would be to get a new car. Yeah. And the problem was we didn't have enough money for either of them. And the listeners were so very generous. There were two donors who gave me $500 a piece, a couple of others who donated reasonable amounts. And so we were able to get Sarah a new car. And that was at a really tough point because she'd just decided that she was going to quit her job and start her own business. And then all of a sudden, boom, her car blows up. You know, people can't tell me that God doesn't have a sense of humor. It's like, is God fracking with me? Yes, God is fracking with you. It's his job, okay? As soon as you start feeling comfortable or feel like things are going to work out, that's when he fracks you. and it's always the earthly bodies of really awesome people that basically bail your ass out at the end of the day. And that's how human... I mean, are humans at war with some kind of a dark, evil entity that just doesn't want us to succeed or something like that? I think we are, you know, personally. I've got some kind of a obscure spiritual belief that I'm like a force for good in this world, and I want to expose evil and try and protect people from it and help to heal them from it if they've suffered any of its effects at all. But, yeah, can't do it on your own, eh?
No. You need each other, and there is a lot of good people out there, eh, Vinny? You know, there's a lot of really determined activists out there, you know, that are sort of doing as best as what they can. But, you know, you get it in the neck from just about any direction when you're an activist, so, eh? You know, especially being a cannabis or reform activist, because, you know, as soon as you go to say something at, you know, meetings or something, they start going on, oh, you don't smoke pot smoking, you know, what would you know about it anyway? You know, and this is even if you're talking about wastewater treatment, you know, which has got nothing to do with, well, actually got much to do with pot, but in a way it has. But, because hemp is really good for cleaning up polluted water.
Really?
A little bit of a use. But as soon as you start talking about it, they just switch off. They've had extra hassles in their local area, and, you know, it's very similar around New Zealand. With all the councils, all their wastewater treatment plants, hardly any of them work properly. They're all polluting the environment and all costing us heaps of money. I mean, you come along to a meeting and say, oh, here's a, you know, how about looking at these sort of plans, like, you know, to clean up the water? Ah, what do you know about the pot smoking, you know? Well, you know, pot smokers, we spend a lot of time studying and we really care about things.
Yeah, I'd say they do. That's another thing that just really, really fracks me off about it, is that people who don't smoke pot think that everybody who smokes pot is this cliche, a crazed moron who's completely unsuccessful in their life and just sits at home all day playing video games and watching TV, never amounts to anything, has no brains, etc. I mean, you know the score. And
yeah.
all evidence is to the contrary in most cases. I mean, sure, those people exist, just like a bloodthirsty pedophile who rapes children and drinks their blood technically exists. But that doesn't mean every person who you don't like is instantly a rapist, bloodthirsty pedophile who drinks blood. Okay? Yeah. You know, they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as it were.
A lot of cannabis smokers actually do really well, so you know, it's just more smear tactics, eh?
Yeah. I mean if they can't say the truth, then just lie about the person, try to discredit them, use ad hominem attacks, because that way, hey, you don't actually need to know anything or do anything. You just need to call people frickin' names like you're in the gosh dang schoolyard again. This is how I win my debates back in the day. I just call the person names, make everybody laugh at them, and then all of a sudden I'm right because everybody's laughing with me at somebody else who I'm abusing and attacking.
Yeah.
Good on you, mate. That's real grown up. You're real frickin' mature, aren't you? Otherwise, you know, stoners might actually have some kind of an input or be listened to or actually help to improve the fracking planet. But no, we don't want that. We just want to abuse them and think that we're better than them because we're abusing them.
Yeah, and yet, you know, the cannabis and the hemp industry is worth, you know, billions of dollars a year in New Zealand. If you sort of work it out per person, it's like a number of thousands of dollars each person per year that we're actually spending or we're losing one way or another just through the war on drugs. You know, it's all our food, it's all our fuel. You know, imagine if New Zealand was making its own petrol and diesel out of hemp. Well, you know, that's, you know, what that's about. I think about $7 billion a year with imports that we don't have to pay for. You know, that's a fair big chunk, though. I mean, when you start putting it into the food, you know, there's more billions of dollars in there. And when I've been eating that hemp seed and the hemp oil, I feel really good. My body feels good, and that's a pretty good indicator, right? And then when I'm drinking when I managed to get some of that RSO oil, that Simpson oil, when I was eating that, gee, I couldn't remember when I'd actually felt better. You know, so that means it's gone back a long time before I felt better, like 20 years or something, since I felt so good. You know, I just felt like I could, you know, when you're young, you feel like you can spring around and bounce around on your feet again. You know, and, oh, well, this is actually really nice. And I was staying focused and getting a lot of stuff done as well, you know. I've got a really busy life, a bit too busy, in fact, you know. So, so I've got all my stuff written down that I've got to do every day, you know, get out there and get it all done. I do suffer from depression quite a bit, you know. I've been stuck in a wheelchair for a long period of time. I'm sore all over, you know, so it's like easy to get a bit depressed. And yet when I'm having that Simpson oil, I'm sort of cruising around my wheelchair, and instead of feeling sad, I'm sort of thinking about stuff that happened years ago that was funny, and I'm actually laughing to myself, you know. It's a huge turnaround, you know, going from, I'm feeling really quite suicidal and stuff sometimes, so you're going from that to chuckling away and laughing to yourself about something that happened to you as a kid. So it's a huge turnaround. So it's just billions of dollars getting chucked away. And it's actually not really getting chucked away. It's what's happening is it's money that's going to the multinational corporations. It's going to the oil and fuel companies, the dolling companies that we actually don't really like anyway. I think you're going to come over here and do lots of billing over here. And, you know, they're going to spill oil over here. Anywhere they've been, they've spilled oil. So to think they're going to come here and not spill oil is just ridiculous. So that's going to destroy a whole lot of our coastline and a whole lot of our seafood that we could be eating as well, you know. So
and that's the least of our worries. There's also the fracking that's going on. I believe I saw a map that a activist Megan Manuka showed me, and I think that they've got something like 40 something fracking locations in New Zealand that they're currently prospecting, and each one of those locations is going to cost like millions of cubic litres of water just to do the process in the first place. On top of that, they're digging down and contaminating the fracking groundwater. Okay? Yeah. So, oh my God. We're going to depopulate this country by destroying it from land and sea, and with the chemtrails, the air too.
Yeah.
Ladies
and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the bleeding uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong with the world? People kill people that other people command. Middle East is a modern day attack on a native land. Project eugenics planned on the common man. Expand the military industrial complex. Annex or install you with chemical objects. Vex the psyop attacking your conscience. Next, your brain agrees with the offense. Political correctness. People are afraid to speak what they feel instead of what they're made out of.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's our final segment here with Billy McKee today. And we were talking about fracking just before, and we got cut off quickly by the break. And you were about to say something, and I forget what it was.
Well, I actually just wanted to know if you could tell me who knows where all the fracking sites are.
That would be Megan Manuka. I'll send you her her Facebook profile link. She's a great lady. And incidentally, she contacted me just a few days ago saying she might have some kind of a medical problem. But she's not sure. And getting scanned and what have you. So who knows? You might be able to help her too, provided you don't quit Green Cross.
What's that?
Provided you don't quit Green Cross all of a sudden.
I've got other people who are actually taking over parts of it for me, so it's sort of taking a bit of the strain off me.
Choice.
Yeah, I'll have a chat to them because it's quite amazing actually, you know, the health benefits you can get from, but, you know, mainly ingesting it actually, it seems to work better, you know, especially on, you know, like for cancer and stuff like that, it seems to work better if you can actually eat it in a concentrated form.
Yeah.
Then, yeah. Because smoking is nice if you're getting stressed out of this.
Well, you know, I found that, and what's interesting is that people have come out recently saying that if you are taking cannabis and it's not heated, you don't get high off it. Is that true? Like if you ate a handful of raw bud?
Yeah, but it could be true because I eat quite a bit of a raw myself. Yeah, you know, whenever I can, and just because I really like it. It tastes beautiful, especially just sort of put it in your, you know, a cup of hot water or something, or, you know, in your food. It just tastes so nice. But I don't think I do get stoned from it, from when I'm just eating it.
Hmm. Well, see, yeah. I found that's quite an interesting phenomenon, isn't it? It's a substance when taken one way will get you high, and when taken another way it'll get you healed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty incredible, isn't it?
There's just so many amazing things about this plant, and it's just what I found interesting is I have conversations with people who are cannabis activists all the time, Billy. You know what they all have in common? Endless examples of things that cannabis or hemp is used for. Just endless. Yeah. Every 2 seconds, they're coming up with another thing. And you're like, wow, it does that too.
Yeah. Well, you'd be getting that stuff from Rick Simpson, as you know, the people that write in there on the benefits they've had from using it. You see his write ups on that?
What you mean, like getting rid of their depression, their cancer, and so on and so forth? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but even people that sort of saying, you know, I was seeing one lady just the other day, she'd had something wrong with her for like years and years and years, and they couldn't get anything, they couldn't help with it. And then she got like a cancer or something, and she started taking the Rick Simpson oil for the cancer, and it fixed up the other thing that had been causing the problems for years and years. And they didn't sort of realise at the time. And then she said, "Oh well, that's gone. You know, that must be fantastic." And there was one lady in Auckland from Green Cross, and she had tumours all through her stomach and her chest. You know, big tumours, nearly the size of a tennis ball. And she started using that RSO oil for about 9 months, I don't think it was quite a year. And then when she went back to the specialist, because they were expecting her to die soon, this is what normally happens when you've got lots of tumours all through your stomach and chest, is you normally die. And she went back to the hospital after about 9 months or 10 months, and they did another scan or something, what do they do on them? and you could see that she actually had the early scans and the latest scans, and you could see the latest scans, and they'd actually shrunk into themselves. The big tumours that were growing through had got, you know, smaller and smaller, and they shrunk into themselves. They were still there, but they weren't causing any problems, and she'd, you know, and she'd stopped having all the prescription medication, which had really ruined her life. She couldn't do anything, you know. She couldn't drive the car, she couldn't look after her kids, she couldn't take care of her husband, because she was so wasted out on these prescription drugs. As soon as she went onto the oil, she could do all that stuff. She could drive, she could be a mum again, you know, she could be a wife again. You know, running the kids around, cooking the meals. It's a busy life if you've got a few kids there. You know, so she was all back on top of that. And at the same time, she healed up. Hurts the
man,
brain,
that,
eh?
that woman needed to be put in prison. That would have done her health real good, eh?
Yeah, well, that's what would have. Yeah, she's terrified. You know, she's really, really scared of coming undone. So that's why she hasn't been able to go to the media or something. I said, oh, let's take this to the media, because we had so much proof. She even had, you know, overseas specialists she'd seen, and specialists in New Zealand she'd seen, and none of them could believe what had happened. They says, oh, how come that's happened? What's going on here? You know, normally you'd be dead like months ago. We expect you to be dead a year ago. You know, but then she's too scared to say anything to them. And she's still getting all the prescription drugs on them, off them. But
She could just tell them that she turned to Jesus. That'd really mess with their heads.
Well, I was trying to get it to say to them, look, this is what we're using, you know, to try to turn some of the specialists around. But they don't want to know about it then, guys, eh?
Well, they're too brainwashed. You know, this is the problem. Those frackers need to smoke a joint, okay, and deprogram a little bit. And incidentally, that's one of the psychological benefits of cannabis, is that you become resistant to brainwashing techniques. Yeah. Why do you think stoners don't like their bosses and quit their jobs invariably? They don't put up with BS for too long. They just can't handle it. It's just like, oh, it's mind control, bro. This sucks, man. I'm getting the hell out of here.
Yeah. I totally agree on that. You know, you just don't like putting up with crap anymore. And I think if you don't smoke cannabis, you can sort of discipline yourself and you can put up with the crap, you know. But once you have a smoke, you say, oh, look, this is just too much. You know, these guys are just full of it. I'm not going to put up with that no more. So it does make you a bit more of a independent sort of person, I think.
Yeah, well, independently thinking at the very least. And the other element is, I think Bill Hicks made a joke about this. Had all these people stuck in traffic, you know, getting angry and tooting their horns and stuff like that, and he just walks out to them and he goes, bro, smoke this. Oh my God, I was taking life too seriously. Exactly.
Yeah, but see, after that they'd have a smoke and they'd think, well, what am I stuck in this traffic for, you know? I'm paying off a car to get me to work that I don't really want to go to. You know, I'm paying off other things that I don't really want to be there, and they sort of, sometimes people just change their lifestyle and say, oh, I'm not going to do that anymore. You know, I can understand it, though. You know, I used to do the, you know, rushing into town every day and working all day in town, then in the traffic, going home again. And, you know, the weekend comes around, and I was just exhausted, man. I didn't even want to do anything. I just collapsed out for the whole weekend, and then, you know, it was another week of it. So, yeah. So I can understand why a lot of people are sick of doing that, eh?
Life is just such a really irritating thing if you take it too freaking seriously. And people are either taking life too seriously or they're taking themselves too seriously. And this is like a chemical compound. It's not even really chemicals, really, is it? I mean, a molecular compound, I think is the technical term. Which can cure pretty much anything that ails you. Are you really pissed off? Well, this will calm you down. Are you really sick? This will heal you. Are you really sick of authority figures? This will make you really, really sick of them.
This will get you to do something.
And it's just a waste of time otherwise to think in any way, shape, or form that prohibition is in any way, shape, or form good for anybody, okay? It's not good for your health. It's not good for your mind. I mean, all it is just poison and mind control. Okay, that's the alternative. You got, on the one hand, you got cannabis, which is good for your brain and good for your body. And on the other hand, you got prohibition, which destroys your mind and your ability to think critically because there's no freaking evidence behind it and people just follow it freaking blindly. And then on the other side, you've got freaking death because nobody's using it as a cure for many, many, many illnesses, which the mainstream medical industry won't admit that they're curable.
Yeah.
Evil, man.
It's evil, eh?
It's just one of these many evil things that goes down in society, and it's understated in a lot of ways. You know, people don't realize just the degree of suffering that goes through the human race as a direct result of this cannabis policy. Now, I think we're coming up to the end, Billy. We've got about 45 seconds. Have you got any websites or projects that you got going on that you need to give a quick plug for the listeners?
Yeah, the Rothschild Drug Wars is a good website to have a look at it, and that's how the drug wars all started off and how that got spread right around the world by done through the United Nations. So it got started off by the Rothschild family in the States and by corrupting the government, which is probably seems to be quite easily done over there if you've got lots of money. And then they sort of corrupted the United Nations and they forced the drug wars on everybody right around the whole world. And, you know, like as an example in New Zealand, you know, they say, oh, we're going to have prohibit cannabis, we're going to have a war on drugs in New Zealand, even though, and they based it on health, even though there had never been anyone go to hospital complaining about, you know, I need to come to hospital because I've been smoking too much cannabis or something. That never happened. So they still managed to, and there'd never been a death, of course, but they still managed to introduce these laws on health benefit. Well, you know, I can't see the health benefit.
No, neither can I.
These small rich people, families,
Yeah, that's about right. You know, it reminds me of that sheriff who him and his wife. I think he must have confiscated some brownies off some stoners or something like that, and not reported them, and then ate them himself, and then calls, and then he started to like trip out a little bit, and he calls up his own emergency services, and he goes, "Man, everything's going really, really, really slowly."
Those edibles, like those biscuits and that.
Billy, we've run out of time, mate. We've run out of time. Yeah. Greencross.org.nz, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back.
Thanks a lot, mate.
Ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island change procrastination in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, well, except for Hamilton. Hamilton, the second largest city in the country, just got fluoride kicked out of the water supply, so that's a good one. But anyway, my very special guests have just both joined us now. We have the illustrious Alfred Labramont Weber from exopolitics.com and Andrew Bishago, the awesome. Chrononaut, guys, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny.
All right. Now, Andrew, you're calling in specifically because of a guest that I had on yesterday, a Mr. Eugene Irvin, and you had a few things to quickly put out about him. You said you know who he really is or something?
Well, I know Eugene Sonny Irvin III. He's been stalking me for a year. He's mentally ill. He first called me in May of 2012 at 11:30 p.m. on a Friday, knowing that I'm in solo practice of law, so somebody in legal practice for themselves, without even a secretary or a paralegal working with me, is usually pretty tired around 11:30 at night on a Friday. And over the last year, or 13 months or so, he has placed numerous late-night telephone calls and has sent me hundreds of unsolicited emails containing both threats and taunts, earning him the seventh place on my cell phone registry reserved for kook number seven. After I began appearing on Coast to Coast AM in 2009, 2010, and 2011, informing the people about the U.S. government's time-space capability and very sensitive political issues like the fact that the last six or seven United States presidents have had prior knowledge of their presidencies as a result of the U.S. time-space capability, I believe the U.S. federal government has put these stalkers in my life. One of them, Kevin Perfield, was arrested about 6 weeks ago by the Portland police for contacting the surviving family members of the Aurora, Colorado shooting victims and telling them that their loved ones were still alive. So one is actually under an indictment. Well, actually, we know that he's, at least it was suggested that he was under indictment in New Jersey for making 20 unsolicited telephone calls to Lisa Beamer, the surviving widow of Todd Beamer of Flight 93 fame. Now, Eugene Irvin was born in 1977, so his claim that he was involved in Project Pegasus as a child can't be true. Project Pegasus was no longer in operation in 1970 or after 1977. He also claims that several years ago at an Army base in Spokane, Washington, he saw me appear as a 17-year-old, having time traveled there, presumably in 1978 when I was 17. I'm now 51. And that can't be possible because I wasn't doing anything for the federal government during my high school years. I simply was doing nothing. My federal experience in the area of defense technical activities of the United States involved 4 years of service from 1968 to 72 in Project Pegasus, which was DARPA's time travel program, and then 4 years of service for the CIA's Mars Jump Room program between 1980 and 84 when I was at UCLA as an undergraduate. My junior high and high school years were devoid of any contact with the federal government. So his subjective claim that he saw me as a 17-year-old, again, is simply not possible. So this man is deranged. And let me just tell you some of the provocative things that he's done, because I know that he just appeared as a guest on your program. He has called me on the telephone, begun a normal conversation with me, provoked me into emotionally venting about my project experiences, surreptitiously taped those conversations, and then placed them on YouTube, which is an invasion of privacy and false light publicity. He has also placed two telephone calls to me in the last year where he's at least reported to me that he's approaching the sentry posts at U.S. Army bases and classified facilities where there are armed guards, unannounced and unwelcomed without any legitimate identification, while talking to me on his cell phone. And my concern there that he was attempting to suicide or get arrested, you know, by being shot or arrested for breaching the perimeter of a classified or sensitive military or other installation in the United States. One was placed in Spokane, he said, at an Army base, and the other was placed from a secured facility in Colorado. So this individual has been provoking military arrest or being shot by military guards while speaking to me on the telephone. Now, who do we think he is, or what, do we have any information about who he might be? He claims that he's the son of Eugene Sonny Irvin or Eugene Irvin, rather, the second, who has been identified as George H.W. Bush's campaign manager when Bush Sr. ran for the U.S. Senate in 1964. I've obtained a photograph of that man standing next to a very young George H.W. Bush, who was only, what, 40 years old in 1964. And Eugene Irvin was younger. He was in his 30s. And the man standing next to a very young George H.W. Bush in that campaign photograph, standing in front of an American flag with the Bush name behind them, bears a striking resemblance to the Eugene Sonny Irvin III that I downloaded from his Facebook personal page when he began stalking me, just to protect myself by knowing who he was. So it looks like I'm being stalked by a mind-controlled asset of the Bush apparatus. And let me just finish out by saying that this stalking began when I began doing radio programs with individuals like my good friend Alfred Weber, and also yourself and Roxy Lopez and Michael Vera, all of whom he's contacted, by the way, in this campaign of harassing me. And I stated during those interviews, you may recall, information that had never been released before, which is that both George H.W. Bush and his son George H.W. Bush and his son George W. Bush both had prior knowledge of their presidencies from around the year 1971, resulting from Project Pegasus obtaining prior knowledge of future events by 1971. So this person is I regard as a dangerous individual, and I disavow anything he has said in the mass media about me or about Project Pegasus. I can provide, even though I've deleted a lot of his voice messages to me, his voicemails, I have not deleted any of his emails, and I can provide hundreds of his harassing emails. It got to the point long ago where I just started archiving them and not even reading them. For some reason, he believes that I'm responsible for saving America's children from mind control on their campuses just because I served in a defense technical project as a child over 40 years ago. So he's deranged. He's unethical. Recently, I appeared on Michael Vera's show to try to forge some kind of common cause with him so I could understand what was going on with him mentally and get him to stop harassing me. And by the next day, he was sending me harassing emails. So I just want to emphasize to your listening audience that after I began revealing the secret history of the U.S. Time Space Program and how it affected very sensitive issues like the protocols by which the American people select their president, the federal government put seven individuals on me with serious enough criminal activity directed towards me to harass me like this individual has, and one of them is already in prison for harassing others. So that's why I wanted to come on today and just disavow any connection to Eugene Irvin beyond being a victim of his criminal harassing behavior.
Okay. Well, so yesterday we had him on for 2 hours and all of that kind of stuff. So he's had his say, and now you've had yours to retort. And as far as I know, that's what balanced journalism is. You let two people who have opposing viewpoints have their say, and then you make up your mind based on that, isn't it?
I concur, Vinny. I'm not in any way disavowing the First Amendment or your fine practice of journalism. I'm just saying that I haven't even listened to the show yet because this person is a villain in my life, just as Kevin Perfield was. You know, people don't know how disruptive this kind of harassment can be. I'm responsible to my girlfriend, my siblings, my other family members, and a growing legal clientele. I use the friendship factor in my law practice. I care about my clients, and a growing body of now 20,000 Facebook friends and members, and a widening group of like-minded souls in the truth movement. And I simply don't have time, not just to answer emails, but to protect myself from these disruptors. And their behavior is intentional, it's criminal, and when you go to the federal and state legal authorities, you get no help. When I went to the FBI regarding Kevin Perfield, somebody who literally moved to the Portland, Oregon, Vancouver, Washington area to physically stalk me, he says it on his own YouTube, I came here to meet with Andrew Bushago. I only knew him as the kook who was harassing me. Okay, I took that to the FBI, that he had contacted my siblings to borrow money from them because he said that he told them he was my friend, which is federal wire fraud, that he was harassing individuals like me and Dr. Sterling Colgate, and Phil Corso Jr. because of the work that we've done or that our fathers have done for the U.S. government, that he has harassed political leaders in the country like Governor Jerry Brown of California and different business and financial community leaders like Warren Buffett and his attorney Charles Munger and their families. And when I said I wanted to meet with an FBI special agent to discuss this person's federal crimes, the FBI special agent out of the Portland, Oregon office directed me to a website on the internet that the FBI maintains to discourage financial fraud on the internet. It had nothing to do with a legitimate legal criminal investigation of somebody who I had revealed what his federal crimes were when I called them. So my point there is that the FBI and the federal and state criminal authorities in the United States are complicit in not protecting public figures from these stalkers. So something as grievous as the terrible wounds that Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords suffered, I am blaming on the U.S. government and its criminal enforcement authorities. This individual, Kevin Fairfield, had threatened me. He had contacted my colleagues like Alfred Lambermont Weber and Laura Magdalene Eisenhower and disrupted.
Can you corroborate that, can't you, Alfred?
Sorry. At some point, I would like to jump in here and provide my own independent testimony about Irvin. And what's very interesting to me, because this is a totally spontaneous convergence of topics, because we had planned that is I came on to talk about the transhumanist agenda. And Irvin, in my judgment, and I've stated this publicly, is a walking example of someone who has been implanted with these new human robotization nano implant technologies. So once Andy has had his say, I'd like to make a statement, if I could.
Well, yeah, thanks, Alfred. I'm done. I just wanted to express my umbrage that I actually took the Kevin Fairfield stalking, which has gone on since December of 2010, and involved him, you know, contacting my siblings, my colleagues, people who I work with on Project Pegasus, like Dr. Colgate, and utterly disrupting our lives. There has to be a crime of stalking when it leads to medical injury of the targets. I've developed medical symptoms as a result of these stalkers being in my life. I have chronic indigestion, and I now have neuropathic pain in my feet and legs that I did not have. I was healthy when they began stalking me. But if you have a constellation of seven individuals in your life that you can't even get the FBI to investigate when they're committing criminal wrongdoing targeting you, it becomes a management problem. You know, I may have $500 or $1,000 or $2,500 in my personal checking account after I pay my bills as a lawyer in solo practice. I don't have the monetary resources to hire a private investigator to shut these people down. This is persecution. And the legal authorities in the United States and the state legislatures, the Congress, need to address it. Stalking has to be made a federal crime. These people use federal instrumentalities to defraud and to stalk, and they need to be shut down and put in prison. Anyway, I just wanted to make my point on that. But Alfred,
Steal
the mic.
Yeah. We've got about 90 seconds before we run to break, Alfred. So make it zippy, and then we'll come back and expand on it.
Yeah. Well, just with regard to this person, Irvin, and I did not hear the program yesterday, but in 90 seconds, Mr. Irvin harassed three fellow talk show hosts, myself, Roxy Lopez, Michael Vera, and Peter Kling, to the point where all of us had to consult privately and block him because he was putting harassing posts on all of our Facebook pages. He was sending us harassing emails. He was calling into our shows, and we finally had to block him. And so I can testify as to that. And in the course of that, based on the the knowledge that I acquired and expertise that I've acquired over the last 40 years of studying this field, which I'd like to speak about after the break, I classified him as a human robot, in essence.
All right. Well, we now have the AFR robot putting on the advertisements. So we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, in just a few minutes at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, Alfred Labramont Weber from Exopolitics.com, and Andrew Bushago from Project Pegasus is my guests, and we'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and replicants, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go freaking nuts. That's a Blade Runner reference, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, in case you haven't seen the movie. All right. and by the way, I've got, for those of you who watch the webcam on YouTube, I've got some pictures of Mars here, which are quite interesting, like, They modify the colors. So, like, on the left here, you'll see Mars with a blue sky and white snow on the ground. And to the right, it just seems like dead redness. what NASA's been doing is they've been taking pictures on Mars. Like, there's a top picture here where you've got a nice little red kind of sandy mountain with a blue sky. And down below is the images that NASA released afterwards, which are modified so that the sky looks kind of gray and dark, and there's no blue to it. So what's happening on that planet, I wonder? And why exactly are they covering up just the colours of it? It's like, well, we can't allow people to realise that Poppy's got a blue sky. It might not be good. People might think that we're BSing about it, and then there might be the previous civilizations and so forth on there. I don't know. Maybe I'm just going off on a tangent. Where were we? Alfred, you had something to continue before we went off to break there.
Oh, well, no. Being on the air now with a living Mars experiencer, we just can't let that question go. And so I would ask my esteemed colleague, who is a Mars experiencer, what his response to that question would be.
Well, I just want to say, by the way, there's a smoking gun right in every library that has a complete collection of National Geographic, because the September 1955 edition of the National Geographic shows the vegetative life forms and the greener part of Mars. And I just got that tip a couple of days ago from one of my members of Mars Anomaly Research Society on Facebook. I haven't even published it yet, but I'm looking for that edition. Somebody's going to send me a scan of it. Essentially, they are attempting to conceal the fact that Mars is a living planet, an inhabited planet, not just because we've been there for over 30 years, but because we're there. There are U.S. installations on Mars. We were going up there via jump room in the late 70s. I was one of those jumpers. And in fact, that is the sensitive nature of the information that I have that would even cause them to put these replicants right out of Blade Runner in my life. And that is this, Vinny, and this is actually breaking news. The number of U.S. citizens that we have now linked to the CIA's Mars Jump Room program, most of them as jumpers, some of them as support personnel, now numbers 17 named individuals. And those have been developed by myself and my fellow trainees and chrononauts who went to Mars with me on occasion and sometimes were present on the surface on other occasions, and we met up, and that's William B. Stillings and Bernard Mendez. So if we begin with... if we begin with Michael Relf and Henry Neumann, who was the Henry Deacon informant to Project Camelot, being the first and second whistleblower to come forward, and then I came forward and brought William B. Stillings and Bernard Mendez, the three of us, myself and Brett and Bernie, have now identified 12 other individuals linked to the CIA's Mars Jump Room program. So at this point, the cat is not only out of the bag on the fact that Mars has been visited for over 30 years, but as was testified to by Laura Eisenhower, about the fact that she was invited to settle on Mars with her two twin boys, Gavin and Garrett, in the 2006-2007 time frame. We now have testimony coming from those who stayed there. For example, Michael Rell, and having stayed there, not just as a visitor, and Laura Eisenhower having been approached to settle there. So with 17 individuals linked to the Mars Jump Room program, there's simply no way this story is ever going to be repressed again and not become part of our common culture. Mars is not only inhabited, but it is, at this point, a colony of Earth.
Well, you know, it sounds very similar to the film Doom. Have you seen the film Doom with The Rock? No?
No, I haven't even read Frank Herbert's novel Doom. I think because I...
No. I think you misheard me. Doom with an M.
Oh, I missed it.
You'll love this, Andy, because guess how they get to Mars? Well, they have a jump room. and the jump room has apparently been there, buried in the desert for umpteen thousands of years, which the ancient civilization of Mars used to escape to Earth from some crap that they created there. Isn't that interesting?
That may be the origin of the jump room. We don't know. We know there was a Hughes aircraft connection. The jump room that we were taking to Mars from El Segundo, California, in the early 80s was at 999 North Sepulveda in El Segundo, California, which in a building that was then owned and operated by Hughes. And I've been speculating because one of my law clients was a private secretary to Hughes at the El Segundo, California headquarters for Hughes Aircraft, which was not the same building. And she told me, much to my astonishment, that when she was working for Hughes in the early 70s, he came to her desk and said, "Rose, there are going to be several men visiting your desk this afternoon. They're not from our planet. They look like ordinary human beings, but they're not from here. So just be very polite to them and accept the aerospace parts that they have for me. And then they'll just drop off the parts and leave." Well, this indicates that Howard Hughes, the titanic industrialist of the 20th century, in several major ways, was in a human ET liaison. Now, I had been speculating that whole story about his condition in the years leading up to his supposed death in 1976 was an obvious CIA cover story, how he had become disheveled, he had grown his hair out several feet, his nails out several inches, and was spending most of his time peeing in a mason jar while eating black walnut ice cream while watching Ice Station Zebra over and over again. And I said, an individual as illustrious as Howard Robert Hughes would not have ended his life that way. Well, now we know from two brilliant researchers by the name of Mark Music, an investigator, and Douglas Wellman, who's an academic in Southern California, who's a book author, that Howard Hughes lived for an additional 25 years after his putative death in 1976. He changed his name to Nick Nicely, which is actually a pun. I mean, when you nick somebody nicely, you basically page money from them in business with a smile on your face, right? Which was Hughes's approach. Anyway, supposedly he lived as Nick Nicely in Alabama with a woman named Eva McClellan for 25 years and died at age 96 in 2001. Hughes having been born in 1905 in Texas. They have abundant evidence in the book, even the presence of his Mormon support team down the road from him in the small town in Alabama where he was living the rest of his life. They have photographs of him. He actually dyed his hair blonde and received an iris transplant in the only country in the world where you can have your irises recolorized, which happens to be Panama. So my speculation during my truth campaign that part of the missing element here was the fact that Howard Hughes, who was a brilliant engineer, did not die in 1976, and was alive during the whole time that we were actively jumping to Mars from a building immediately south of the Los Angeles International Airport that he then owned and operated.
Incidentally, in the movie Doom, the jump room that they go into is underground just outside of Los Angeles city limits.
Well, there you have them taking true facts and spinning them as fiction, which if you think about it is a brilliant form of disinformation, because by fictionalizing fact, you convince the public that fact is fiction. another huge linkage here is Bernard Mendez, our good friend and fellow jumper, was a personal friend with not only Hughes, but Richard Milhouse Nixon. We also have the CIA linkage to Hughes. As Mark Music found, during the remainder of his life, Hughes was carrying a CIA telephone that could not be traced. So Howard Hughes was, in fact, a top CIA operative. And the strange thing is that his behavior during the end of his life was as if he was basically moving around quickly so that he wouldn't be assassinated. So I think Howard Hughes may turn out to be a much more positive figure in American history than he has thus far been credited as being. But he lived on a very dangerous and strange footing during that last quarter century of his life. But I believe that Hughes was still alive because, for example, the testimony of Bernard seemed to indicate that both Hughes and Nixon were following the activities of the Jump Room program, Hughes after he had supposedly died, and Nixon after he had left the White House, you know, the presidency, in disgrace in August of 74. I said, you know, you're talking about Nixon. Nixon left office in 74. How could he have any involvement in the Jump Room program if it began in the late 70s and was really in its heyday when we were jumping in the early 80s? And he said Nixon was following it. And I said, you mean he was following the Jump Room activities in retirement in San Clemente? And Bernard said, yes, he was engrossed in it. He even wanted to know about all of the jumpers. He would read like thumbnail sketches of what the government knew about their pasts and their futures. So it just keeps on getting stranger. We've now linked, in all likelihood, the Jump Room program, not just to Hughes, as we had already done through several data points, but to the Hughes that was the true Howard Hughes, who did not die in 1976. That was an imposter who had been used as kind of a decoy, that they would move around and, you know, they'd have him move into a hotel in Las Vegas or Los Angeles and say, well, Howard Hughes has just rented the penthouse suite. And Howard Hughes might be in some place like Panama or Alabama or someplace that he would never be found. So anyway, that's the story that, in fact, you know, we were fed information about people like Howard Hughes written by authors like Michael Drosnin, basically freelance writers on contract, when we were given our cultural understanding of these figures. But who was ever told that Hughes had not just designed the Glomar Explorer to snatch a Soviet submarine off the floor of the Pacific Ocean, but it also worked with the Martian humanoid civilization to place some of our explorers on the Red Planet? And similarly, who read of the sad story of Richard Nixon in retirement after resigning the presidency in disgrace, had it ever been told that he was so interested in the more advanced activities of the U.S. government that he was actively following the affairs of the Mars Jump Room program after he left office? But this is the hidden history that's now emerging.
Well, lots of hidden history seems to be emerging, particularly in this day and age. And my concern is, though, as well, you know how JFK was assassinated over 50 years ago, and government documents and things like that, they stay classified for a certain period of time. And even now, when, what? You'd have to be, what's the term, mentally retarded in order to think that it was just a lone gunman that killed him, I think is the technical term. The truth still has not really come out. And I feel really quite apprehensive that the truth will ever come out about any real major or important issue that threatens the status quo and the elite and their plans for humanity. I mean, suppression syndrome just seems to be infinite in a lot of ways.
Well, I would aver, in the case of the Kennedy assassination, that the truth will be known and that the ultimate mastermind of the JFK assassination was Lyndon Baines Johnson. And the reason I'm predicting that, Vinny, is that I practice criminal law, and one of the major aspects of criminal law that defines it really is forensic evidence, basically criminalistics. And in the vast literature of the JFK assassination, including 150 or more books, 200 books, there's been very little forensic-based physical evidence. But there is one conspicuous piece of evidence that has never been rebutted, that was entirely admissible as a very good piece of evidence, and that would put anybody in prison. Just like the fact that the glove at O.J. Simpson's estate had not only his blood on it, but the blood of both victims, which is hard to do if you're not responsible for a murder. But in the case of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, one of the only pieces of reliable forensic evidence is the palm print of Malcolm Wallace on one of the boxes in the sniper's nest. Malcolm Wallace was Lyndon Baines Johnson's assassin. In the Billy Sol Estes case, it was revealed that Johnson had ordered the assassination of seven individuals by Malcolm Wallace, including his own sister, Josepha Johnson. The Johnson Foundation would not have threatened to sue the History Channel were it not for them reporting that in the final episode of Nigel Turner's classic treatment of the assassination, which was entitled The Men Who Killed Kennedy. And the last episode of that was The Guilty Men. And I would predict that that work of journalism will stand the test of time because that palm print was reliable. It contained about 26 indicators that was the palm print of Malcolm Wallace. Malcolm Wallace had been tried for first-degree murder in a circumstance in which Lyndon Baines Johnson, as a young congressman, had rented a hotel room across from the courthouse where Malcolm Wallace was being tried for the murder of a farmer by the name of Henry Marshall, who had disrupted Johnson's illicit bribery conspiracy involving federal agricultural allotments in Texas. So I don't, for that reason, I respectfully dissent on the notion that the Kennedy assassination will never be told. It will be told, and I believe that as Philip Nelson found, the mastermind of the Kennedy assassination was President Johnson.
Well, and dovetailing with that, I mean, saying that it's never going to be told, I mean, I don't know that. But the other element is, will the people responsible ever be punished? Is Lyndon B. Johnson still alive?
No, I don't think the participants will be punished.
So something tells me he skipped out on any possible court punishment. You know, sorry, can't punish me. I'm dead.
Well, here's another one for you that may show how they actually implemented the conspiracy. I discovered...
We don't have any time. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.
Uh-oh. Speedway rappers, but I've never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles, but I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am not yet credible, so until I can say I'm credible, I'll say that I'm incredible, respectable.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's as credible as an edible extraterrestrial. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com. All right. Enough of the fun. Well, in fact, that's kind of what we've been doing most of the time here with this fun. Okay, I don't know about you guys, but I'm feeling very exhausted. You know what I mean? When you haven't taken a break for several months and you're working all day, every day, you're talking to this person, that person, and mate, your brain just kind of starts to die eventually. It's like it's asphyxiated from relaxation in a sense of the word, and that's kind of what I'm going through right now. So very, very shortly, whoosh, I'm gonna give myself a break of some description. It's going to be blissful, you know? Sit at home and it'd be good to have a holiday. Would anybody be able to donate me some gas money out there? Go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, click on the donate button, and a keyword, Vinnie Eastwood's petrol, to go somewhere to relax. That'd be nice. Okay. Now, we were talking about quite a range of subjects already, guys, going from replicants stalking Andy to Mars anomalies to nanotechnology and now the JFK assassination. You know, who can really cram that into an interview of this size? I don't know. Well, anyway, I seem to be having a little bit of problems with my stuff here, so I'm not sure if you guys can even hear me. But if you do, please continue to take it away. Alfred, we haven't heard from you much this interview.
Well, you know, I think that my piece really was about the transhumanist agenda, and to bring it back to where we started, it was just doing two things, providing firsthand testimony to back up what Andy stated about one Mr. Irvin. Let me get his full name here. Eugene Sonny Irvin III. Number one, having stalked four of us talk show hosts, namely Roxy Lopez, Michael Vera, Peter Kling, and myself, and demonstrating, by putting all of these posts on our Facebooks, messages sent to us, emails sent to us, that characteristically contained circular, nonsensical arguments and texts that he was a victim of MK Ultra, but I think beyond that he was really a target of these nano implant technologies that are part of a program that a number of European experts that I interviewed over the last couple of weeks characterized as, quote, a global enslavement program. And these nanotechnologies have now shifted from electromagnetic waves, which were favored back in the 1970s, so that, you know, the remedies of tinfoil hats and lead helmets are not going to be successful at blocking these. Now they've graduated to scalar waves, and what has been set up are super quantum computers, a grid of super quantum computers in the quantum cloud that are used to control what they call pipes, like your brains, your entrained brains are called pipes now. And these are a reference to the brains of humans that have been taken over via implants that you can breathe in through via chemtrails and that can breach the blood-brain barrier. And the implanting of brains can also take place via frequencies derived from an individual's DNA, which is harvested from blood samples. All infants they have blood samples taken from them at birth precisely for that reason, so that they can be robotized from birth. And any medical lab tests that you have, well, your DNA goes on file. And this organization is now doing free public tests for RF radio frequencies. And at a recent one in London, just members of the public, 40% of the members of the public tested came up positive for RF frequencies, meaning that they had been chipped and were now being controlled via scalar waves. At a recent reading, 100% of the public that came up to be scanned for RF frequencies were emitting RF frequencies, meaning that they had been chipped, either from the chemtrails or from DNA samples or other means. And they found one five-year-old child that was emitting RF frequencies, meaning that children are at risk. Now, to talk a bit about the super grid, over 1,000 grids, including the grid that we use for our electricity, have been connected into a mind control. Into a mind control super grid that is connected to HARP as a master planetary mind control machine that coordinates these scalar technologies, super quantum computers, a quantum cloud, the super grid of over 1,000 grids, and is coordinating a growing population of human robots or robotized humans. There was a an estimate now about 3 years ago that already 6 million persons in the European Union, that's a very conservative estimate, were productized robots. I mean, one used to think that the transhuman agenda was that they would manufacture these robots and they would become super intelligent and the robots would take over. No, it's not that. It's that humans would be increasingly robotized and the human race would be taken over as robots and controlled by the controllers, who are the financial and monarchical bloodlines, and other controllers who would not be so taken over, in coordination with dimensional manipulatory ETs. So that is what the situation is, and it's fairly serious, because Andy can testify now, and he's done it with dates and names, at least two of these robotized humans, one of whom is directly connected to the campaign of George H.W. Bush, who as CIA director was instrumental in implementing a lot of these technologies as CIA director and during his presidency. So it all wraps up in a neat little bow if you look at it from an historical kind of time sequence. And this, in my judgment, is possibly one of the most challenging agendas that faces the human race among its many, many challenges. There are so many challenges vying for our attention now that they're like overwhelming. But this is an amazing challenge. One of the they're beginning to find some things to be able to counteract it. For example, homeopathic gold, they found, can counteract these new scalar technologies. So you can get that at any health food store. But this agenda has already taken over all of the institutions worldwide, the governments, the legislatures, the courts, the police departments at the cybernetic level, at the control level, are all being led increasingly by robotized humans. So this is a grave concern. I've been working. I had an initial meeting 2 days ago with the group in Brussels, and we're now working to have an international congress there that would have experts in the technology, experts from the people who are being targeted, so they can talk about it from the medical perspective and from the juridical and legal perspective and from the communications. How can we begin to awaken the planet? Because this is going forward in an atmosphere of complacency and secrecy. You know, humans, and very few of the robotized humans know that, in fact, this has occurred to them. So this is quite the challenge. So I really want to commend Andy at coming forward so forcefully and with so much data to make this public.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Andy, for your work. Thank you, Alfred, for joining us today as well. I was just thinking about the, what would you call a robotized human? Could you call them robotussins? I'll take that as a yes. Okay. We'll see you again sometime, guys. Alfred Weber, ladies and gentlemen, exopolitics.com, and Andrew Bashago. You can check him out, the Mars Anomaly Research. You can search that on Facebook. It should come up with his group. And if you have some free time now, I'm going to do an after-the-show chat. So listeners, if you want to join us on the chat room, I'm on Skype. Vincent.Eastwood is my Skype name, and we'll be starting that conversation right after the show in just a few seconds. So thank you very much. See you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.